Well, it's good to see a bunch of young people here this morning. I apologize. I had intended to come and stop in yesterday, and I didn't get that done, but I trust the tournament went on anyway. So which one of you won? They're not here. Okay. Okay. Well, we want to welcome each one to the service this morning. Ask you to turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 1. And I've titled the message, Trust That Creates Courage. To give a bit of background to this chapter, previous to this, we are familiar with Joseph, how he was put in charge of the food supply during the famine in the end of Genesis there. Joseph's own family needing to come and get food from Joseph, who was identified in through a chain of events there. And then finally, the king actually told Joseph, just go ahead and bring your whole family, move them here to Egypt. And so here we are, the beginning of chapter or the book of Exodus, and I think it's about 350 years, as near as we can tell, that passed between the time where 70 of Joseph's kin moved to Egypt and the time that they actually leave Egypt then after the plagues. So about 350 years period of time. But I'd like to read our text, chapter 1, and we're also going to cover chapter 2, but for the sake of time, I'm only going to read chapter 1. But it says, Now these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob. And then it names the 11 sons of Jacob. And then at verse 5, all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And then Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all of that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, they increased abundantly, they multiplied, waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, that they would join unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Python and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, the name of the other Puah. And he said, When you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, you shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, Why have you done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So here in the first five verses, it tells us the names of all of Joseph's brothers. And verse 5 tells us that 70 of Joseph's kin came to Egypt. Verse 6 tells us that Joseph died along with all of his brothers, and all of that generation is now off the scene. And so it tells us that a lot of time is passing. In that time period, the children of Israel were really multiplying. Verse 7 tells us the children of Israel were fruitful. They increased abundantly. They multiplied. They waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them. Look at all the description that it gives there. And then verse 8, there's a new Pharaoh that is now king. And enough time has passed that this king, who is now in power, did not know Joseph. And this king became concerned about the size of the children of Israel. And he was afraid that they would become more in number and mightier than the Egyptians. And then verse 10, the fear was, in the event they end up being in war with anybody, that the Hebrews would actually fight against the Egyptians as a way of escaping from this slavery. And so the Egyptians came up with this method to suppress and slow down their growth, they thought. But verse 11, they did it by charging heavy taxes to keep them poor. They forced them to build the cities of Pithom and Ramesses. And at first, the straw was provided to them. But then, to make it more difficult, they had to go out and gather their own straw and still make the same number of bricks as they did before. Verse 12, the more the Egyptians made life miserable and hard for the Israelites, the more the children of Israel increased. And so what the Egyptians meant for evil, or meant to weaken them, God used to strengthen them. You see, this was God's purpose for Israel, even if they didn't realize it. Egypt was actually a protection for Israel. It was a place where they rapidly grew from a large clan to a mighty nation. And the nation couldn't grow like that back in Canaan because it was practically impossible to avoid intermarriage with the people of Canaan, which were pagan and wicked inhabitants. And so by being in Egypt, they were actually racially biased and had such an entrenched system of racial separation that Israel could grow there over several centuries without being assimilated into the culture. And so this growth, in spite of affliction, has consistently been the story of God's people throughout all ages. The more they're afflicted, the more they grow. As the ancient Christian writer Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And I think we still see that in persecuted places today. Verse 13 and 14, the Egyptians treated them harshly, making life more and more difficult. All of this was an attempt to break their spirits, to ruin their health, and to shorten their life. And they also discouraged marriage because children would be born to a slave and it would actually distract the slave from doing the work. So nothing they tried slowed down the growth in numbers among the children of Israel. And so they go to trying inhumane methods of suppressing them. Late-term abortion, murder of their children. And so because God's purpose was to bless Israel and fulfill his role for them in his eternal plan, no amount of affliction could defeat his purpose. The Egyptians tried their best through cruel slavery. Didn't work. And the principle of Isaiah 54:17, I think, is proved true here. It says, "No weapon formed against you shall prosper." And so the wickedness of the Egyptians could hurt the children of Israel, but it could never defeat God's plan for them. Verse 15, Pharaoh the king met with Shiphrah and Puah, who were over the other midwives, and they were told to get all of the midwives together and agree to kill all the male babies from the Hebrew women. And the purpose was to utterly weaken and practically destroy the people of Israel in just one generation. Well, Shiphrah and Puah were likely not the only midwives here. They met with the others, but they were likely the ones in charge, as they were the ones being named here. It says here in verse 17, "But the midwives feared God." Now, they very likely feared Pharaoh as well. Pharaoh had power. He had position. But Pharaoh was also a murderer. Would we not fear him? They feared God more than Pharaoh. For them, the choice was clear. The civil government commanded something that was clearly against God's command. And so the midwives did the only right thing. They obeyed God rather than men. They regarded God's law and dreaded God's wrath more than Pharaoh. And so they refused to murder the male babies as the king commanded. In verse 18, the king realizes that things aren't going as he wanted. And so he calls in the midwives and he asks them, "Why are you saving the boy babies?" In verse 19, the answer the midwives give is, "Well, the Hebrew women deliver quickly." And many people assume in reading this that the midwives actually lied to Pharaoh. But it may not be the case. The midwives may have told the truth in that maybe the Hebrew women were hardier than the Egyptian women. And yet the midwives did not explain all the reasons why they were saving the babies. Verse 20, God dealt well with the midwives. And then he repeats how the people multiplied and they waxed very mighty. And so even if the midwives deceived Pharaoh, the deception was not what God was blessing. He blessed their godly bravery in obeying God before men. The worse the persecution against God's plan to multiply the children of Israel in Egypt, the more God made sure the plan succeeded. So this is a wonderful example of the goodness and power of God. Pharaoh said less. God said more. Pharaoh said, "Stop it." God said, "Go for it." So if the battle were just between Pharaoh and the Hebrews, the children of Israel, Pharaoh would have clearly won. But the real battle included God, and that changed everything. God obviously won the battle, but he won his victory through some courageous individuals that were willing to take a risk. They were courageous. They were willing to stand up to the power of Pharaoh and do what was right. Took courage. God's blessing on the midwives was that he enabled them to have children of their own then. Usually midwives didn't. They stayed single to take care of other people's children or the deliveries. But twice it gives the reason for God blessing them with children of their own. And it was the fact that the midwives feared God more than Pharaoh. Verses 17 and 21. In Joshua 1:9 it says, "Have not I commanded you? Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee, whithersoever thou goest." And so, with the plan not working, Pharaoh becomes desperate. Verse 22, Pharaoh made a far more radical command, and that was that all male babies are to be killed, thrown into the Nile River. Some scholars believe that it even included the Egyptian boys. I'm not 100% convinced of that because it clearly says in verse 16, when you deliver the Hebrew boys or women there to do that with the Hebrews. So I wouldn't conclude that for myself. But we see in chapter 2 then, going to chapter 2, that the method that Pharaoh used in commanding the death of all male babies actually became God's way of raising up and deliver Israel. He raised up Moses. So you have a baby Moses who opens his eyes to an unfriendly world. He was born in a powerful nation. He was a foreigner. He was oppressed during a time when all babies such as himself were under a royal death sentence. But Moses had something special in his favor. He was the child of believing parents. Now, Moses wasn't the firstborn in his family. He had at least an older brother, Aaron, and an older sister, Miriam. But it isn't until Exodus chapter 6, verse 20, that we're told Moses' parents' names. And it was Amram and Jochebed. But Moses' parents hid Moses, likely around the house, maybe in a closet, maybe in the basement. Well, they probably didn't have basements back then, but they kept him hid for 3 months. And it tells us in verse 2 that he was a good, healthy child, likely with healthy lungs. How do you keep a 3-month hid? Well, they did it because of their faith in God. They sensed that God was going to do something through this son. And when it became more and more difficult to hide him, the mother was weaving a basket, putting pitch on it so it wouldn't leak, so it would float. And she put baby Moses in the basket, and she put him in the river. She did exactly what Pharaoh told her to do. She put the baby in the river, but he was in a basket. She made sure that the basket was watertight, and it floated in the river. It's an example of trusting the child's welfare and future to God. You know, when Moses' mother, and maybe Liz and Emily can kind of put yourself in these shoes along with other mothers, but I pick on them because they're most recently mothers. How easy would you find it to put those babies in a basket, turn them loose on the river, and simply trusting God for their future? That's what Jochebed did. When she let go of the boat made of bulrushes, she gave up something very precious, trusting that God would take care of the baby. And maybe God would find a way of giving him back to her. I think it was probably in the back of her mind. Verse 4 tells us that Moses' sister Miriam stood way back and she was watching. We aren't told whose idea that was. But when Pharaoh's daughter found the child, Miriam goes into action. And we see that Pharaoh's daughter came to the river for her daily bath. And with God's guidance, Pharaoh's daughter found the basket there in the water. Curiosity got the best of her. And so she had a maid go out and pull that basket to shore. And when they opened that lid, God had the baby cry at that precise moment. And Pharaoh's daughter's heart was soft. She had compassion. And she recognized this is a Hebrew child. And I believe it was providential that Pharaoh's daughter found this baby. Had it been anyone else, would Pharaoh have been as gracious in letting her keep it? And it's interesting that Moses' mother was afraid Moses would reveal himself by crying. And some years later, when God asked him to be his spokesman, he said, "I can't talk." But we see that the cry of Moses in that basket melted her heart. God brought together here two things that he made. He made a baby's cry, and he made a woman's heart. And he brought those two together at this precise moment. And by now, in verse 7, Miriam is at her side. She offers to go get a nurse to nurse the baby. And Pharaoh's daughter agrees. And so Miriam went home. And she says, "Mom, come quick." And verse 9, Miriam brings the mother to baby Moses and to Pharaoh's daughter. And Pharaoh's daughter offers to pay the child's mother to take care of this child, to nurse it. And so now in God's providence, the child is placed into his mother's loving arms, where she can now not only nurse it, but teach it godly values. And in the process, she's going to get paid. Do you see how God had this beautifully planned for the deliverance of both Moses and eventually for the people of Israel to be freed by Moses' leadership? He skillfully directed those parents of Moses. He skillfully controlled the currents of the Nile River. And he gave compassion to the heart of Pharaoh's daughter to further his plan and his purpose. God arranged a way for Moses' mother to train him in his early years and be paid for doing it. And so we see how God rewarded the faith of Moses' mother, both as she trusted him in hiding Moses for 3 months, and then also as she trusted God by setting Moses into the river. Courage. And now Moses' parents could teach him for several years. And how diligent they must have been, knowing they have a short period of time before he was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. Moses was taught in the ways of the Lord and the children of Israel's customs before he was then later taught in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And he became mighty in words and deeds. Being the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, Moses is now in the royal family. If he went somewhere, I'm sure he went in princely chariots, maybe with guards. If he floated on the Nile River, it was in a fancy boat. He lived a royal life. And so this turn of events shows how God moves when we act sensibly and move by faith. The mother of the child was called to nurse and to teach him and be paid for him. You cannot beat God when he's moving in our hearts and lives. And so for 40 years, Moses is in Pharaoh's court, being trained, being raised as an Egyptian. He was educated in the great Temple of the Sun, which was the outstanding university of that time. Moses, we're told, was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in word and deed. And when he was 40 years old, he had a desire to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, verse 11. While he was there, he saw an Egyptian take advantage of an Israelite. And so Moses steps in, defends him, and kills the Egyptian. Moses deliberately decided to identify and side with the people of Israel rather than the Egyptians. It says in verse 12, he looked this way and that way, which is the action of a person about to do something they know they shouldn't do. And the Bible explains some of Moses' thinking behind this action. In Acts 7, 23 to 25, it explains that Moses did this to defend and avenge the beaten Israelite. But he also expected his fellow Israelites to recognize him as their deliverer. He thought he was setting himself up to be their deliverer. But in God's thinking, Moses wasn't ready for the job. In that passage, Acts 7, 23 to 25, it says, "Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed, and struck down the Egyptian, for he supposed his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. But they did not understand." So just like Jesus, Moses could not deliver when he lived in the palace of glory. He had to come down off that throne, away from the palace. He had to go into a humble place before he could deliver his people. In Hebrews 11, 24 to 26 says, "By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward." Moses knew who he was. His faith in God, in the God he served, helped him to know who he was. And so the next day, he came to two Hebrews that were fighting. So he asked them, "Your brothers, why are you fighting?" And one of them asked Moses, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Are you going to kill us like you did the Egyptian? Who made you a prince and a judge?" Moses seemed to act like a judge, like a prince, given his royal background. He acted like a judge in that he determined that one of these men was in the wrong. And so he seemed to be the perfect prince and judge for Israel, but they were not ready to want him. A prince has the right to rule and expects your loyalty, and a judge has the right to tell you what to do and punish you if you don't do it. So in rejecting Moses, they said to him, "We don't want you to rule over us. We don't want you to tell us what to do." But you know, people rejected Jesus the same way. And just like Moses, Jesus was rejected at his first coming. Are you aware that both Moses and Jesus were favored by God from birth? Both were miraculously preserved in childhood. It's said of both of them that they were mighty in words and deed. Both offered deliverance to Israel. Both were rejected with spite. Rejected in their right to be prince and a judge over Israel. And just like Jesus after him, Moses could not deliver when he lived in the palaces of glory. He had to come down from off that throne, away from the palace, and into a humble place before he could deliver his people. And when Pharaoh heard about the killing, Verse 15, he wanted to kill Moses. And so we have Moses fleeing. For now he knows that they know that he killed the Egyptian. And God put him on the backside of the desert. And so now Moses is away from his kin, the children of Israel. He's away from the Egyptians that raised and trained him. And he finds himself in Midian. He's likely feeling that God's plan for his life was completely ruined. Every chance he ever had to deliver his people are gone. But you know what? At this moment, Moses was exactly where God wanted him. Moses probably had little idea at the time, but before this, he was too big for God to use. Moses tried to do the Lord's work in man's wisdom and power, and it didn't work. So after 40 years of what seemed to be perfect preparation, God had another period of preparation for both Moses and the people of Israel to make them ready to receive Moses. And finally, coming to Midian, Moses met the daughters of a priest of Midian, very likely a descendant of Abraham's other children. And because of that connection with Abraham, we have good reason to believe that this man was a true priest, and he worshiped the true God. Well, God led Moses to this specific family for this specific time. These daughters of the priest came to the well to draw water for their father's flock. The shepherds came, shoved them away. And so Moses stepped in, and he helped these daughters. You know, in Egypt, Moses enjoyed life as one of the royal family. He was waited on hand and foot. In the desert of Midian, Moses finally had an opportunity to be a servant. He did a good job, worked hard to help water the flocks of Reuel's daughters. He was given a wife, and they had a son. And Moses seems to give up on Egypt and his hope of delivering Israel. Moses was content where God put him, even though Midian was a far cry from what he had in Egypt. So he had a son that he called Gershom. The name means stranger. It's kind of evident that he was lonely, living apart from both the Egyptians and the Hebrews. We make a mistake, I believe, when we assume that the years in Midian were wasted years for Moses. They were instead working years. He had never worked this hard all his life. God trained him, shaping him for his future calling. Moses certainly was not on the shelf. And in Egypt, Moses learned how to be somebody. In Midian, he learned how to be nobody. And that's what ultimately led to God being able to use him. Verse 23, the king of Egypt dies. The Israelites sigh a sigh of relief. They're thinking, surely our bondage is going to come to an end now. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered Israel and their affliction. When Israel groaned because of the bondage, God remembered he had made a covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, God did not choose to deliver the Israelites because they were superior to the Egyptians, or because they had been true and faithful to him, or because they had not gone into idolatry. These people were very unfaithful to God. They served idols rather than him. But God's desire was to deliver them because they were in a helpless, hopeless position in slavery. And God gives two reasons in verse 24 why he's delivering them. He heard their groanings, and he remembered his covenant. I made a covenant. that I'm going to keep. And so the desperate, hopeless condition of Israel appealed to the heart of God. God did not turn his attention to Israel because they were such good people, but because of the covenant that he had made with them. He gives his love, his attention to us on the same basis. The covenant relationship we have with God through Jesus is not because of us, it's because of his love. God saw no good in Israel, but he heard Israel's cry in bondage, and we'll see how he redeemed them. But in the same way, he saw our desperate condition, and he saved us. There was nothing attractive about the children of Israel, and there's nothing lovely about us that would make him want to save us. But God made a covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that promised the redemption of Israel. And he agreed to save anyone that trusts in Jesus Christ as Savior. And because of that, we have a person that we can place our trust in. And it should create within each of us a courage that we could not have without it. Our trust in Jesus Christ should develop courage. Trust in Christ creates courage in the same way that it did for Moses' mother when she placed him in the river. The same way that it gave Moses courage in his time of waiting. You know, 40 years is a long time. Moses died at 120 years old, so he didn't live a lot longer than our lifespan today. 80 years of that was waiting. 40 years in Midian. So trusting in God develops a courage to do what God wants us to do. And I want to leave that as a challenge for all of us, that first of all, trust God. And as we trust him, it will build our courage to be all that he wants us to be. Travis will ask you to lead us in a closing song and then call for Daryl and Kim.